Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous fireside room, today's speaker is Michael Pellett, and he will be speaking on double dosage, Mark 8 and 9. So let's listen in on Michael Pellett.
This week and next week as well, I'll be teaching the Bible study sessions here at Holden and looking at the Gospel of Mark and Mark's understanding of discipleship and what it means to be a follower of Jesus as Mark sets that up. And so far this week, we've looked at the parable of the sower and the seed, recognizing that that's a parable of the soils. The different ways in which people receive God's word and how that word bears fruit or works in them, which is another way of talking about discipleship. So I've kind of used that parable of the sower and the seed as kind of setting out the broad range of discipleship. We have then narrowed that down a little more in terms of saying that in Mark's gospel, Mark uses the character of Peter as kind of a primary indicator of discipleship and in some sense a problematic discipleship. That the word Peter means rock. And that usually when we think of Peter as a disciple, Peter is the rock, right? Solid, firm, the kind of person we should be. But Mark, whose gospel I think is just loaded with irony and humor to get us to think about things, really says that, yeah, Peter is the rock, but probably like a good nickname, we should think about him as Rocky. And so if Peter is rocky, I mean, sometimes rocky can be the rock firm and solid, but more often to be rocky is to be a bit more unstable, right, and problematic. And that often what happens on rocky ground is that you stumble and fall. And in Greek, that word for stumble is scandal. Or one could say, we are scandalized. And that we saw in the explanation, in Mark chapter 4, in the explanation of the parable of the soils, that the seed that falls on rocky ground for Mark means that these are the kinds of disciples who, after receiving the word, at first are very excited, they're impetuous, they're compulsive, they stand up and volunteer right away, they're outspoken. Remind you of anybody you know in Mark's gospel? And when pressure comes along, when tribulation, affliction, could use the metaphor, when the heat is on, what happens? They wither, they die, they stumble and fall. They are scandalized by the outside pressures that are there on their faith. And so throughout the gospel, Mark talks often about these rocky disciples. Peter, who is rocky, but also links most of the disciples together as these kind of rocky disciples who often, to kind of, as we've characterized it tongue-in-cheek, they're kind of the stupid disciples, right? That the disciples in Mark's gospel just don't get it. They're always kind of stupid. And that's kind of where we end up, or where we've ended up in our last session, and now we're going to go into a transition in terms of the disciples are kind of stupid, and the news is it gets even worse. And so to again kind of set that context, that we ended up on Wednesday in Mark chapter 7, verses 31 to 37, which is the healing of the deaf mute. And that link again between hearing and speech, hearing and speaking, and how the understanding is that for discipleship, what must come first is that sense of hearing. We need to thoroughly and clearly hear God's word, hear what God is telling us, listen to that, because with clarity of hearing, then follows the clarity of speech, of speaking, of witness, of living, of discipleship, so that together, in this way, hearing and speech together is what discipleship is about. And that healing story is an indication of that, right? Remember verse 34, Jesus says the word ephatha, be opened, or the Greek there would be more emphatic, like be thoroughly opened, be completely opened. And once the deaf man's ears are opened, what happens? His tongue was released and he spoke plainly. So that clear hearing is what enables clear speaking, plain speaking.
Right.
That sense now, this person understands, knows what's going on, can hear it, and can speak it.
Right.
And good disciples, if you will, can both clearly hear and clearly speak the way of Jesus. All right, then we get into chapter 8, and the beginning of chapter 8 talks about the feeding of the 4,000, which is, again, much like the feeding of the 5,000. And I'm not going to look at that particular account, but just note how it ends. That after the feeding of the 5,000, the feeding of the 4,000, after this whole section, this first part of Mark, which is the Galilean ministry of Jesus, right, that started in the middle of chapter 1 and now goes all the way to the middle of chapter 8, that first chunk of Mark, you can say, these disciples have been following Jesus around for months, right, hearing what he has to say, seeing what he does, and after all of this, right, what's going on? Verse 17 of chapter 8, right? They're talking about things and they're really confused and all of that. And in verse 17, and becoming aware of it, Jesus said to them, why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes and fail to see? Do you have ears and fail to hear? And do you not remember? And then back to verse 21. Note the way this whole first section of the Galilean ministry ends. Then he said to them, do you not yet understand? Don't you get it? And the answer is that we as the readers, right, as the smart disciples, right, don't forget that you're smart disciples, at least for a while. That's going to change today. You're not going to be so smart anymore. But as smart disciples, because you know from chapter 1, verse 1, what the right answer is, Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, we can see that after all of Jesus' ministry, the disciples still didn't get it. Right? They still don't understand. They can maybe see a little bit, but they're still, right? They're still, to again use those phrases, hard of hearing. They don't see, right? Unclear in their seeing. Or to use another phrase, again, a Hebrew metaphor. They have hard hearts, right? Disbelief, unbelief, even unfaith, right? They didn't get it. And so now we're at a transition point. They didn't get it. So now what do you do? I mean, in this sense, and again, I think some of Mark's humor comes through here, you kind of have two choices. Jesus has two choices. Think about this, right? Here you are, the head of a company or the head of a department, and you had these trainees that came in 8 months ago, and you've put them through the intensive training process, and day in and day out, they've heard everything you've had to say, they've watched everything you've done, and after 8 months, they still don't get it. What do?
Fire
them. Right? That's one of your options, right? Fire them. You know, these 12 jerks, out of here, right? Next bus, out. Fire or no fire, out of here. That's one option. And you start over, right? Pick another 12. Get 12 smart disciples this time, not 12 dumb ones, 12 rocky ones. Or what's the other option? Start over with the bunch you've got, right? Do it again. And the section in Mark, if you will, from 8:22 through 10:52, which is kind of the second big section in Mark, which outlines Jesus' journey to Jerusalem. Again, kind of geographically, we start at Caesarea Philippi, let's just say it's up here, Jerusalem is down here, and in these chapters, in this section of Mark, we kind of just follow Jesus and the disciples as he gets closer and closer to Jerusalem, closer and closer to the cross. And all along the way, again, Jesus engages in teaching. And in this section is where Mark gives us the three, what's been called the three passion predictions. And we'll look at the first one today. There's one in chapter 8, chapter 9, chapter 10. And in each one of these three predictions, there's kind of an easy outline, a three-point outline. First, there's the prediction. Jesus says, I'm going to Jerusalem, I'm going to suffer, die, rise again. And each prediction becomes more explicit in the detail and so on and so forth. After Jesus makes that prediction, each time on the part of the disciples, because again, remember, they're stupid disciples, there's some kind of misunderstanding. They don't get it. Something goes awry. After that misunderstanding, if you will, given that misunderstanding, again, Jesus looks at that, as I guess all teachers do, and say, even if it is a misunderstanding, this is what? A teachable moment. So even though, I mean, you know, the bad news is these guys are dumb, they're stupid, they misunderstand, but a good teacher will say, but it's a teachable moment. Mm-hmm. And so each time after that misunderstanding, it is followed by Jesus in terms of teachings, sayings, and what, right? The teachable moment, all of which, again, are basically focused on notions of discipleship. Right? What does it mean to be a follower of Jesus? How do we understand following Jesus and what that entails? So that just like those disciples, we as smart disciples too can be tuned in on that and say, okay, so all of this is for our sakes, that this is a teachable moment for us, to help us in our understanding of what it means to be a disciple, to be a follower of Jesus. It's this teachable moment. Okay. To look at the way Mark sets up the first passion prediction and all of the passion predictions. And again, literarily, the way Mark sections off this part of the gospel is that it is bracketed by, at the very beginning, there is the healing of a blind man. So you have a blind man healed. And then there's the three passion predictions, and it ends with the healing of a blind man. Blind Bartimaeus. So again, if you will, you start with blindness and a person receives sight. You end with blindness and a person receives sight. The kind of ironic question in all of that is to say, but here as well, we also start out again with blind disciples, right? Don't you still understand? Don't you get it yet? So they start out blind, but to say, at the end of this section, will they receive sight? Will they have sight? No. Finally, the answer, I think, Mark gets is always, unfortunately, no, or not yet. They still don't get it. But not to give up. And the sense about not giving up, Jesus' understanding of this, to look very quickly at the healing of this first blind man. This is chapter 8, verses 22 through 26. And I just want to note a few parallels between this healing and the healing of the deaf mute in chapter 7. Verse 22, and I'll read here from the New Revised Standard Version. They came to Bethsaida. Some people brought a blind man to him and begged him to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village. And when he had put saliva on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked him, "Can you see anything?" And the man looked up and said, "I can see people, but they look like trees walking." Then Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, and he looked intently, and his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Then he sent him away to his home, saying, "Do not even go into the village." What I want to look at here is the phrase, "Can you see anything?" And then the first response, "Well, people look like trees walking." And then the second action of Jesus, "And he could see clearly." Again, one way of looking at this miracle story is as an account of perhaps how discipleship works, or maybe where the disciples are at the present moment, right? To hold out a little hope for them. That to say, okay, they have followed Jesus all the way through the Galilean ministry. Can they see anything? Well, maybe like people look like trees walking. That there is a sense here that they have some kind of notion of sight. But it's very shadowy. It's very blurred. It's not very clear. And that what? Jesus again needs to teach again. Help them to hear again. Tell the stories again so that there can be that clear-sightedness. That sense, if you will, I'll try to make a distinction here with words between vision, between sight and vision, or perhaps in terms of a sense of knowledge and action between perception and understanding. That now at least the disciples do perceive they do know there is something about this Jesus that's different than other people and other prophets and everyone else they've come in contact with or heard about, right? They can perceive, or to think about it in terms of our sense of sight, right? So, you know, sometimes you can perceive things. Those impulses are coming into you, and you see, although it might be blurry, shadowy, fuzzy, there's still not the clarity of vision, the clarity of understanding. And so as we get into this first, what we'd call Peter's confession, right, that Jesus is the Christ, that one might say, perhaps, and even there, Mark is going to leave that open, perhaps Jesus, or Peter and his disciples perceived who Jesus is. But at best, that's very shadowy. There is not that clear vision, that clear understanding. But this is also a question for us as disciples that Mark wants us to think about. Right? Can you see anything? I mean, after all, you've read 8.5 chapters now, right? Can you see anything? Well, yeah, but it's kind of shadowy. It's kind of blurry. We too have, I mean, right, we know the right answer, but sometimes merely knowing the right answer, or maybe even just simply perceiving the right answer, may not be that we understand. To say, okay, yes, I know Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, that divine agent of God who will bring about God's salvific will, but do I understand what that means for my life as a disciple? Well, that's kind of blurry. That's kind of shadow. That's not clear. I don't know if I have caught the vision of being a follower of Jesus and what that all entails. And so, just like this blind man, just like these other disciples, I need another dose. I need to hear again about who Jesus is and what that entails for my life as a disciple, so that I can catch the vision, come to a clear understanding of who Jesus is and what that means for my life as a follower of Jesus. That's how Mark, I think, is setting up this second section. Luther, in one of his sermons on this healing miracle in Mark's gospel, also, I think, interprets and understands it this way. And in his sermon, he tells his listeners about discipleship and following Jesus. He says, quote, "You cannot find it yourself, so you must let Christ lead you as though you were a blind man. Wherefore, it is not you, no person, no living creature, but Christ himself who instructs you by his word and spirit in the way you should go. Not the work which you choose, not the suffering you devise, but the road which is clean contrary to all that you choose or contrive or desire. That is the road you must take. To that Christ called you, and in that you must be his disciple." Right? You see, trying to catch that vision. How do we catch that vision? It is Christ who gives it to us, who leads us in understanding that. Or just one other metaphor of talking about that. Those of you who have been at the Village earlier this week and heard Bishop Medardo Gomez's sermon about the you know, weaving a tapestry and the crooked lines and the straight lines, and how God's lines seem to be very, very crooked and meandering and twisting and going all over the place. And of course, we, from our perspective, want straight lines, you know, get there and be done with it. And the difference, right, in terms of our lives and what that means. Again, another metaphor in understanding, I think, this section of Mark's Gospel. Okay, from this, and the way Mark wants to set this up for our understanding, we can look at verses 27 through chapter 9, verse 1. The section here where we have the first passion prediction, the misunderstanding, and the teachable moment. We'll see how we get through this. First of all, again, the way Mark sets this up. In verse 27, Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way, he asked his disciples. On the way. And for Mark, again, as I've said earlier, that's always a tip-off that we're going to talk about discipleship. Because who we are as disciples are always people on the way. Remember, as we talked about Jesus' evangelism program, for Mark's gospel, Mark's understanding of what kind of model for evangelism do you follow is the Exodus model. And the Exodus model, Exodus literally could be translated as on the way, on the road. And so that here again, the discipleship model that Mark is presenting to us is that kind of Exodus model. The people of God, the community of faith, the individual disciple is always a person on the way, on the road. It's moving. It's dynamic. It's always kind of outgoing rather than trying to be centered in a way that is stable, static, so on and so forth. And so while on the way, Jesus first asks a very general question, right? Who do people say that I am? What's the word out there on me? What are folks saying? And we get the different responses. John the Baptist, Elijah, one of the prophets. In verse 29, then, the specific question, but who do you say that I am? And, right, surprise of surprises, who answers? Rocky Johnson. Oh, we don't answer to that. Peter answered, you are the Messiah. Okay, smart disciples, how do we grade Rocky?
Are you done, Kirk?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right answer, wrong answer?
Mostly right.
Mostly right? What did he get wrong?
I think we have one at least in the...
What, Messiah?
Yeah. I mean, there's a difference between Messiah and Son of God.
There might be, although for Mark that's very close. At this point I don't think we'd want to draw a distinction between that, that to be the Messiah is to be the Son of God. But okay, he got the answer right.
Okay, we'll get that.
But you are, you're really smart disciples here. Because you said there's a difference between the right answer and, let's say, the right understanding. And so that's the kind of tension that's going on here. Peter does present us with the right answer. And at one point, one could say, on the surface of the story, Peter gives the right answer. And we should all be jumping up and down with joy, be overjoyed to say, yes, finally, he gets it. And one could say that Mark would want us to say that because it's a very dramatic point in the gospel, because this is the first time in Mark's gospel that a human being gets the right answer. Before then, who was ever giving the right answers that Jesus is the Christ, if you can recall from Mark's gospel? Who else before this says Jesus is the Christ? The demons? And who else? We'll see how smart the smart disciple. No.
Satan.
We can link Satan with demons and all that. very opposite, God. The baptism of Jesus, right? The voice from heaven. So there's the, if you will, and right, one can say it kind of comforting. God knows who Jesus is, and right, the demons know who Jesus is. So you've got, if you will, a polarity.
The opposite extremes, but everyone and everything else in between doesn't know. Until now. Or you would say, we think until now, right? Now we finally have a human being who says Jesus is the Christ. And so we should all be cheering, yay, oh, great, except, right, note Jesus' response. And he sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about him. Sternly ordered, or some translations may have the word rebuke in there. It's the same word that Mark uses when Jesus, right, rebukes or commands the demons to be quiet or to come out of somebody. Right? It's for Mark again, the way of depicting this is the strongest kind of language Jesus ever uses. It's the language that really saves when he's in open conflict against the demonic forces. He says, you know, shut up! And so here, you know, Jesus says, you are the Christ, and Jesus' response is, shut up! What's going on here? You get the right answer, and you get one of the strongest, harshest responses that Jesus ever gives to anybody. In fact, Jesus never rebuked any other human being that way. This kind of language so far has been reserved only for the demons. So you can imagine the disciples, and particularly Peter, is not real happy about this. Huh? And even we as smart disciples at this point, I think, have to scratch our heads to say, what's going on here, right? The right answer and a harsh warning to shut up. You know, maybe Peter didn't give the right answer. Uh-oh. Now let's go, right? So, I mean, Mark is bringing us into a whole notion again of opening all of this up. We're kind of perplexed now. What's going on here? And so because of this perplexity, right, we can say, now we're starting to get into the teachable moment. Because we're scratching our head. What's going on here? Time for some teaching. Teaching, first of all, about who Jesus is. And that's the passion prediction. Verse 31. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said all this quite openly. Or again, one could say quite plainly, clearly. A reference back to that deaf mute who spoke plainly once he heard and understood who Jesus is and what God is about. Like that blind man who, after that second dose from Jesus, sees clearly. Now Mark again is indicating here we have with crystal clear expression who Jesus is. And an amplification on that in terms of, yes, we as smart disciples too know that Jesus is the Christ. But who is the Christ? The Christ is the one who suffers, dies, rises again. So that the teachable moment here is that understanding that Christ and cross, just to, you know, collapse all into a quick sum, right? Christ and cross go together. That, you know, maybe we as smart disciples knew that ahead of time, but now that is crystal clear. open, plain, no questions about it, if you will. Christ and cross go together. They're constitutive of what it means to be the Christ and to be a follower of this Christ. Now he says this, all right, openly. And the rest of verse 32. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Right? So again, the same word, if you will, Peter is saying, well, you talk to me like you talk to the demons. I'll respond. So when Peter rebukes, if you will, it's the kind of same thing. Peter takes him aside and says, shut up, Jesus. Didn't you get it right? Mm-hmm. Stop talking like that. Don't be a madman. Don't be crazy. Like Mom said back there in chapter 3. So Peter is talking to Jesus the same way in which Jesus talks to the demons. And of course, for us now, I would hope, as smart disciples, this kind of action by Peter should even be more shocking than Christ's action toward him. Because now, right, we are confronted with the fact, what does it mean that Peter refutes the Messiah? That the follower of Christ refutes the Christ? Kind of the bottom line to all that Mark wants to present, and again, I think it's humorous and ironic, but also profoundly true, is that what's happening here is Peter is saying, shut up, Jesus, I know you're the Christ, but who's in charge here? I am. So you got to stop talking like that. I mean, you've got the wrong game plan for being Messiah. So, listen to me. That whole ironic twist that Peter's rebuke of Christ all of a sudden is Peter's way of telling Jesus, now I know you're the Christ, but follow me. I've got the way. I have the kind of understanding. So that in terms of the stupid disciples, they're no longer stupid. We've gone into a transition. Unfortunately, right, the disciples personified by Peter have moved from ignorance to arrogance. Or, right, the good old-fashioned notion, right, of what we would call pride. The kind of problematic that we can see characterized in Genesis 3. Where the human being, Adam and Eve, know better than God does what's best for them. And so here's, well, Peter, that rocky kind of guy, moves from ignorance to arrogance. He knows better about what it means to be a follower of Jesus. In fact, he even knows better what it is to be the Messiah than the Messiah himself. And he makes no bones about letting Jesus know that right away. And Jesus does not stand for that at all, right? Jesus again rebukes Peter. And this time, in case you didn't make the connection before implicitly, this time the same word rebuke is used, and now the connection is made explicitly, right? Get behind me, Satan. For you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things. Right? The whole understanding here of Christ and the cross as God's way over against the other kind of human ways that do that. And so to have a little wordplay here, it's the kind of thing that within our discipleship, as we are on the way, how does our way get in God's way?
that's kind of the challenging question that Mark is posing to us. As we are on the way, how does our way get in God's way? And here is one of the threads. Here's one way that that happens. And in that most dramatic and radical kind of way. The other thing here for Peter is the, or for Mark, is the word play, right? Get behind me, Satan. Get behind could also be kind of translated like go behind me, with the notion of kind of go away, understood. It's a word play that back in Mark 1 verse 17, when Jesus called Peter and his brother Andrew, the word of invitation is come behind me. And so what, you know, kind of word play here again, and Mark loves word plays in that. Note what we have here is practically a reversal. That in Mark 1:17, Jesus invites Peter to be a disciple, right? Come behind me. Now, it's go behind me. Right? If you will, it's almost as if Jesus disinvites Peter. It's almost as radical as saying, don't follow me anymore. Which is, again, right, a little shocking. But why would it be so harsh as to say almost, don't follow me anymore? It's because if you are following this way, right, the human way, that way of Satan that does not hold together Christ and the cross, let's face facts, you're not following me anyway. So let's not pretend. If you're going to follow the human way, then don't follow me anymore, because you're not following me anyway. Let's just be clear about that. Again, I think a tremendously tough, challenging question to say, is there ever a cause or reason when we as followers of Jesus, when we who are people on the way, should be disinviting others because of their following? And say, well, don't follow us anymore, because the truth is, you're not following us anyway. Don't accompany us anymore, because the truth is, you are not accompanying us anyway. I mean, that seems at first a tremendously judgmental kind of attitude. I kind of feel uncomfortable even saying that, even thinking about that. And yet, the other side of that is, what about accommodation? Compromise. Does being a follower of Jesus mean anything goes? Or even to back off a little bit from that to say, well, not anything goes, but you know, we can accommodate. We can, you know, strike compromises between God's way and human ways. And so we can mix those two together. We can mediate them. And so, you know, that's not so bad. But again, as I said earlier, Mark is a, right, and his gospel is a very radical way of saying things. He would say, no, that kind of, oh, we can compromise, we can accommodate. That's that rocky kind of discipleship, isn't it? That's truly being, again, scandalized and stumbling over that kind of demand, if you will, that being a follower of Jesus the Christ places upon us. A following that we could only fulfill because of who Christ is and what Christ does. But yet, Can we accommodate? Can we compromise? Or must the line be clearly drawn? Again, that question. While we are on the way, what gets in the way of God's way? And if something gets in the way, should we say, wow, we'll just carry that with us? Or if something gets in the way, pitch it out of the way, toss it out of the way, right? If you will, disinvite it. I think it's a tremendously difficult question and challenge that Mark presents here. I'd like to hear your comments on that in just a minute. Let me try and work this through a little bit yet. Verse 34 and following. Right? Now, after this, Jesus goes back and calls the crowd. So the disciples have heard this, but now it's going to be again for everyone. Jesus, the sower, is tossing out the seed on all the various soils, that they too can receive this, and we can see what kind of growth and discipleship follows from it. So with the crowds, he again, right, repeats in different sayings this same kind of thought about God's ways versus human ways. If anyone wants to become my follower, or to come behind me, again, it's this kind of phrase of invitation. Right? If anyone wants to come behind me, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. Now again, Mark is getting a little sneaky on us here. Right? Let them deny themselves. Okay? What would be the option? If we would not deny ourselves, what would be the other option?
Deny Jesus.
Right. And so, I think here already, right, Mark is giving us somewhat of a foreshadowing of what's going to happen in chapter 14. Is Peter's denial of Jesus, setting the framework to say what could already be the mindset of Peter that he could deny Jesus. And in one sense, the mindset is already given right here. What's Peter's mindset that he could deny Jesus? Because he does not see that clean link between Christ and the cross as God's way. And he persists on following a human way. And to finally say, and if you follow that human way, right, again, much irony, Jesus who follows God's way in Jerusalem ends up on the cross. Peter who follows the human way to Jerusalem ends up where? In denial. So, again, for Mark, there is no accommodation, there is no compromise. It is either God's way or human way. It can't be both God's way and human way, which is what we would like, because after all, we're nice, compromising, accommodating, agreeable, negotiating kinds of people. And Mark is saying, can't do that. Because when that happens, that human way finally leads to denial. And so that radical course of denying yourself, right, taking up your cross. Note again, I think we sometimes think that being a follower of Jesus means that we also take Jesus' cross. So here it's, you know, we all take up our cross. Our situation of suffering that comes from being a follower of Jesus, from God's way. I mean, here again, kind of, Mark is telling us, you don't have to worry about carrying anybody else's cross. As a follower of Jesus, your own cross will come to you. Count on it. That situation, because it will always, as it happened to Jesus, right, will put you in conflict with human ways. and those human ways, those powers are going to be out to get you. And the way in which they are going to be out to get you is, I think, again, very subtly indicated by Mark that in verse 28, you know, who do people say that I am? You're John the Baptist, Elijah, one of the prophets. If you go back to chapter 6, verses 14 to 16. And that reads, right, again, they hear of you know, Jesus is sending out the disciples, verse 14. King Herod heard of it, for Jesus' name had become known. Some were saying, John the Baptizer has been raised from the dead, and for this reason these powers are at work in him. But others said, it is Elijah. And others said, it is a prophet, like one of the prophets of old. But when Herod heard of it, he said, John, whom I beheaded, has been raised. And then Mark goes into the whole story of the beheading of John the Baptist. I think here, again, Mark very subtly is setting up that indication that note those first, right? Who do people say I am? John the Baptist, Elijah, a prophet. I mean, if you will, that's what Herod was saying. We know what Herod does to people who follow God's way. Because Herod clearly recognizes that if one follows the way that John the Baptist talked about, if that's God's way, his sense of power, control, rule is done for. And so there is only one thing you can do for those people who advocate following God's way. Get rid of them. And so as well here, there's this ominous sense in this section of Mark's gospel, again, that ominous realization to say the powers of this world aren't going to like this program at all. You know that from the beginning. Note that this will be out and out conflict in that those with power from the human way will do whatever it takes to get rid of you. And if it means killing you, they will do it. And again, we can get into a lot of the things of what's happening, for example, in Central America and what's happening often with the church in Central America. Right? It is an indication that when the church advocates God's way and that what God's way is about the human dignity of all people, justice, and all that follows from that, that love of God and love of neighbor go together, those who are in power, those who follow the human way, find that intolerable. They must be killed. They must be disappeared. They must be imprisoned. And the really indicting thing about all of that is that basically the advocate of the human way is the governments of the developed countries. And particularly, if we're going to point fingers, the government of the United States. So if one wants to look at this in terms of the political dimension of discipleship in here, it's saying, well, citizens of the United States, Canada, elsewhere, are we going to follow God's way, or are we simply going to make the comfortable, accommodating compromise and let our governments continue to follow those ways that are opposed to God and continue, if you will, to kill the followers of God? Tough question. I'm going to leave it at that kind of question. Okay, let me stop here. I'm probably going to talk way too much. and open, you know, questions, comments, reflections. And again, particularly think about that challenge that, you know, while we are on the way, what gets in the way of God's way? And do we have to take that radical step, either within our own lives or within our own Christian community, that at times we have to engage in disinviting, uninviting, a kind of cleansing and purifying that says, no, we cannot accommodate, because accommodation finally leads to denial.
Marty, it seems that when the church does that, it's usually, I think the church has bought that concept. Particularly, you see that doctrinized by the concept of venial and mortal sin, and to say, oh yes, there are some things that as soon as you do those, you endanger the community as well as yourself, and we need to do that. The problem when that gets specific always, it's always the wrong thing, because it's always the wrong thing. So the church has a long and sad history of doing that kind of rebuke, and I can think of very few examples that would be in harmony with the kind of thing that where the gospel would say, yeah, that is really a danger to the community.
Right, and Mark, in that sense, right, Mark has addressed that issue in chapter 7, right, where it was precisely having to look at that notion of, is what's happening here human tradition, right, and the example used was the korban, right, is a human tradition that you're holding to, and you're kicking people out, if you will, because they're not following the human tradition, or is it God's commandment, God's word? And that, again, in terms of that sense of judging and discerning, right? It's never easy. The challenge is always there, but it's there to say, right, is what we're doing for the sake of the gospel, or is it just another human power play? As I noted, and again, Mark oozes irony there. In chapter 7, verse 9, Jesus says to them, you have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to keep your tradition. Well, what's translated there is fine way, and the Greek is kalos. And so Mark would be saying, you have a beautiful way of rejecting God's way to keep your way. Right? It's beautiful, right? It's aesthetically, structurally, politically, just beautiful. I mean, we've got a tremendously nice song and dance. I mean, it just oozes irony. So it's a good point. Others, I should just let you talk and not comment.
Along the same line, accommodation, the creating of accommodation to put up the light for me, because in a sense, God's way is the way of accommodation. And the Hebrew people kept getting it wrong, and God was patient. Peter got it wrong, but he wasn't disinvited. He was corrected, but he kept Peter as a disciple. And even after the resurrection, the disciples never got it right. There's this gracious accommodation. I know it's not the kind of accommodation you're talking about, but when we talk about accommodation, I think we need to be careful.
All right. That's a good point, and again, another question, and maybe there's something we slip into. Is grace or forgiveness, put that one up.